Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to Matt and Cheryl's Gen Excellent Playlist. I'm Matt.
I'm Cheryl.
And we continue our musical journey through Gen Xer's life. We started back in 1972. We've reached the year 1981. This is our third episode for 1981. We'll be adding 18 songs to our growing playlist, which started with Don McLean's American Pie back in 1972.
It feels like it was in 1972 when we did our first podcast.
Hey, this has got staying power. So the reason for that is we take little detours. Our first two episodes of 1981, we focused on specific topics, the murder of John Lennon and its aftermath and the responses from his former bandmates in our first 81 episode. And then we focused on the hip-hop of the era in our second episode. This will be a regular look at the year, and we're kind of doing it chronologically now, so we're starting at the beginning of 1981. So the songs we're looking at here in the early part of 1981 kind of tie together. You had a couple of artists, one band and a solo artist, who released major works in the 1960s, but then had big hits here in early 1981. And I want to start with one that's dear to Cheryl's heart. We've talked on many occasions about The Who being one of her very favorites. She's already picked a couple of Who albums for Album of the Year along our journey here on the podcast. So now in 1978, The Who releases Who Are You? And shortly after the release of that album, the death of the drummer Keith Moon, due to an overdose of a drug prescribed to him to battle his alcoholism called Heminevra. A couple of years later, Led Zeppelin has a similar tragedy with the death of John Bonham. They decide to call it a day. The Who presses forward. They've toured a lot at the end of the 70s. And then there's another tragedy at the end of 1979 with a concert at Cincinnati's Riverfront Stadium, home of the Bengals and the Reds, when a bunch of Who fans rushing to get into the stadium to get to festival seating, open seating. What was it? 13 deaths, I think.
And yeah, it was like 11 or 13. Yeah.
It's horrible, horrible tragedy. And the concert actually did go on that night. So they've had to deal with these two traumatic occurrences and the decision to go on. They plug in Kenny Jones, the former drummer with the Small Faces and the Faces, to take Keith Moon's place. Very different style of drumming with Kenny Jones. And then, of course, you've got the shifts in music here as we head into the 80s, a lot of different sounds. So The Who come out with their Face Dances record early in the year. And the first single from that is You Better You Bet. And that's Cheryl's addition to the playlist, but a song that was on both of our lists. And I think it's right up there with The Who's greatest singles.
Yeah, me too. And it's actually one of my favorite songs they do live, too. And they always have it in their set list. It's just such a great song to sing along with. It harkens back to sort of like really early days of their singles, of songs like Substitute. You know, it has that more bouncy feel to it. It just feels more like a single. Whereas, you know, most of the Who albums up until really sort of Who Are You were more of either a concept album or more like a song cycle that flowed as a whole album. But this is definitely a single. And Face Dances falls right in between Pete's two solo albums from the early 80s, Empty Glass and All the Best Cowboys Have Chinese Eyes. And so, you know, he's still writing for the band. He's still writing for The Who. He's the main songwriter for the band, but he's also writing for his own solo material. And this is a song that could have fit on Empty Glass, I think. Well, actually, it probably could have fit on both of those two solo albums, because he even had a song on Chinese Eyes called Face Dances Part 2. So he was, you know, writing this material like simultaneously. But I definitely think that this is a song that benefits from Roger's vocals. Not all Who songs work in that way, I don't think, but this song does. It's kind of a strange time in the band. It's their first album post Keith Moon's death with Kenny Jones. And like you said, he's a much different style. I mean, nobody is like Keith Moon, so
no.
It's really difficult to replicate that style, although I do think that Zach Starkey has done a great job of that in his own way. But Kenny Jones, you know, he was much more of a timekeeper, and he wasn't trying to be a Keith Moon type drummer. He was just being who he was. And they had known him for a long time. Like you said, he was in the Small Faces and the Faces, and they had, you know, been around the same circles. And so, you know, they were very familiar with him as a person and as a musician. So it makes sense in that way that they would bring him on. But I think it was a little bit shocking for a lot of Who fans, because Keith Moon was just so integral to their sound that it really did change the band. However, the album before this, Who Are You, Keith is in such decline at that point. It isn't really that big of a jump in that regard. But, you know, he was just so beloved, and he was just such a big personality and just such a big part of that band that I think that people were kind of dubious when Kenny Jones came on. I mean, he really had a raw deal because he was never really going to be accepted as a full band member. I wasn't a fan of The Who at the time, but because, you know, You Better You Bet is really much more of a pop song, and it actually fits in really well with the era of, like, kind of a new wave-ish sort of feel to it. Pete's always used synthesizers, so it really wasn't a leap for him to kind of get into that.
He was really on the vanguard with the use of electronic keyboards in a rock context.
Yeah, he definitely was. So songs like Let My Love Open the Door, you know, like, those just slotted right into that early 80s sound. And You Better You Bet doesn't really have as much of a synthesizer. It has more piano in it, but
there's a lot going on in the mix in that song. It's a good headphones listen.
Yeah, there is. I mean, a lot of it is kind of like back in the mix a little bit more. It's not in the forefront, but I do think that it has a contemporary sound to it, but it doesn't sound dated either. It's basically Pete telling a story about, well, he's in his 30s at this time, and I think he was dating, like, some young chick, and he was trying to impress her. And, you know, it's got these great lines in it, like, listening to T-Rex and Who's Next, you know, referencing their album, Who's Next.
I didn't pick up on the Who's Next until researching this. I mean,
oh, really?
I remember the T-Rex.
Drunk
the time
myself, blind to the sound of old T-Rex. Who's next?
Right. The T-Rex line, I wouldn't have gotten it at the time because I didn't know it was a reference to another band.
I
wouldn't have known about T-Rex at that time. But it's so clever. And then the Who's Next, I didn't pick up on that little line. And there's so much detail on this song. It's, the lyrics are incredible, for one. And then Roger sings his tail off. Really, I mean, it's funny. This album really divides Who fans. It got a lot of flack at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of Who fans really like it a lot. I've kind of swung. I mean, I've had it for a long time, but I never listened to it that much.
Which I think is the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly.
They just didn't take the time to really delve into it.
Yeah. So, I mean, my first impression was, great single to lead it off. And then Another Tricky Day at the end. That's a classic Who song that's had staying power. And it was a big part of their live show. But the rest of it, nothing really stuck out. After a few listens, its positive attributes come through. Now, there are a lot of negative attributes, too. It's a different sound for them. And you can make the case that maybe they shouldn't have gone on as The Who without Keith Moon, because he's just such an intrinsic part of their sound.
Yeah.
And you can argue all day, what is it that makes The Who The Who? It's not any one element. It's the whole mix. It's Townsend's worldview and songwriting. It's Daltrey's vocals. It's the extraordinary bass, the lead bass of John Entwistle. And then it's just the wild drumming of Keith. It's the whole mix. And it's hard rock, but with a strong pop feel, a mastery of melody and harmony. Beach Boys, huge influence. You could hear that screaming through on a lot of Face Dances still, but really throughout their run. The harmonies are an overlooked aspect of The Who's great music. So, I mean, some have said they're the first power pop band. I think that's a pretty good argument to make with their 60s singles. But what's lacking in Face Dances is that power. So they bring in Bill Simzik, who's one of the top producers in rock and pop this time, with his work with the Eagles and others. Mm-hmm. So on the positive side, they get maybe their best vocals of their career at this point. And Roger is in great form all throughout this record.
Yeah.
He sings his tail off, particularly on You Better You Bet. That's just a tremendous vocal performance on this.
Mm-hmm.
But other songs on the record, this doesn't affect You Better You Bet because that's a pop song. It's not a heavy rocker. But they do have some heavy rockers on this album, and they just lack that punch that you're used to from Who music. Mm-hmm.
Right. That Keith would bring for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
My other quibble with the album is the sequencing. I think the two worst songs on the record come right after. So it leads off with You Better You Bet. So it starts with a bang, a mm-hmm. great classic Who's single. And then comes Don't Let Go the Coat. Big mistake to have Roger Daltrey sing this. It's very personal song, and it's a tribute to Pete's guru, Meher Baba, who he's been with for years at this, more than a decade at this yep. point. This is not something Roger Daltrey should be singing. And just the whole song sounds
and
inappropriate.
And it doesn't fit his voice anyway.
No, I mean, it's not just, at all.
It's got this lightness to it. It's great. It would fit Pete's voice. And he does record the song in Cash Cash, which is the song after this, too.
Right.
There are versions of both of those songs with Pete singing on his demos. And it just seems like it was a mistake to let Roger sing those songs, and just Pete should have just taken over lead vocals.
Pete should have had those, and one should have been on side one, one should have been on side two. They should not have gone back to back.
And Don't Let Go the Coat was actually the second single on this album, which is, they really should have brought out Another Tricky Day. That was never a single.
It's not a bad song. It's just kind of there. It's not, it's boring. You know, it's just
boring. It is. And it's certainly not single material. And that would be one of the songs that's the most polarizing for a Who fan. And that kind of goes into play too of Pete's solo work versus the Who work. It's very different. I mean, it does cross over at times. Like, he gets pretty heavy in some, you know, and more in the rock vein in his solo stuff. And the Who can also be more, you know, introspective and slower tempos. But I think for the most part, it's pretty easy to pick out the songs on this album, especially that should have been left for Pete's solo work.
Yeah. Or as B-sides, maybe.
Yeah. Or let Pete sing them and not have Roger try to take over the vocals on these songs that really don't make sense for his voice and for just the subject matter.
So after those two tracks, and again, they're not bad songs. Cash Cash, I think, suffers in the verses from that lack of punch and power. So those are strong.
It's
powerful.
A lot better on Pete's solo version of that song is much better.
And then I don't like the chorus. The bear. What is he going on about with bears and there's no bears, and I mean, it's just goofy. Again, I probably haven't listened to it enough to get all the symbolism, but it's just not.
There's not enough there for you to delve into. Yeah.
Although, again, I could hear where it would be better in a different production, maybe in a live context, and maybe with Pete singing instead of Roger. Mm-hmm. After those two songs, I think the album is very strong the rest of the way. And there's some great stuff on there, but with caveats. So after Cash Cash, you get the John Entwistle song, The Quiet One. This is a raging rocker from Entwistle. Again, it doesn't have the punch that it should have.
And it does also sound like a song that could have fit on a solo album for him, because it really does feel out of place in this album, too. It doesn't really mesh with the other songs.
So the disappointment that a lot of people felt, there's a lot of anticipation for this record because it's been 3 years since Who Are You? Keith Moon's gone. There's a new drummer. It's a major, major change. So obviously a lot of the attention is focused on Kenny Jones. Mm-hmm. And when this album comes out and it's not punchy like you're used to, he gets a lot of the flack for it. So I think we'll both come to Kenny Jones's defense. There's some great drumming on this record.
Yeah.
It's just not what you're used to with Who music, which, again, if they maybe not released it as The Who, maybe it gets a different reaction. I don't know.
Well, and back then, there was a much different attitude about changing members and bands. And like you said, Led Zeppelin decided to stop.
Right. And again, the album suffers in that context because Led Zeppelin says, we're not Led Zeppelin anymore without John Bonham. That was
so. They're like, why are the Who? Yeah. So why is the Who continuing on
this?
And why? I mean, now people don't even bat an eye that there may only be one member who isn't even maybe an original member of a band, and they're still calling themselves Yes, for example, is doing that.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
it's like, okay, whatever. But back then, they were still young. These guys were young. Bonham and Moon died in their 30s. Early 30s. So yeah, I think it was very controversial. And I think Keith Moon was just such a huge personality.
Right.
And Kenny Jones is just in the background, really doesn't stand out at all, even just as a personality. So, you had that contrast too. But I don't know if they could win either way. If they would have brought somebody in that was more like Keith Moon, then they might have been panned for trying to replace Keith. And I think that they were really kind of intentionally going away from that because they didn't want it to look like they were trying to necessarily replace Keith in that sense. It was more like, now we have a new drummer. There was not like this big fanfare about we're bringing on Kenny Jones. It was more like, we'll just kind of like slip him in and just, you know, and our sound will change with it too. And that is what happened.
I guess we should mention another name too. John Rabbit Bundrick is the keyboard player on this album. He is not credited as a band member, I don't think, on this record, but he's all over it. Particularly You Better You Bet. It's a great work on that.
All the flourishy piano on there is him. Yeah.
So side one ends with a bang. And then here is, I think this is Kenny Jones' shining moment on this record, is his drum pattern on Did You Steal My Money, which is a really... Mm-hmm. It's a very different sounding track for The Who. Yeah. And so you have the loss of Keith Moon. So you lose that essential element of their sound. But at the same way, it's liberating for Pete Townsend, because I think he wanted to experiment with some different sound. I mean, he's a guy, he's very on top of musical trends, punk, new wave. He's following all of this and soaking it up. And he wants to try some different rhythmic exercises. And it's just, he felt shackled to Keith Moon, and he was frustrated by that. And as you mentioned, Keith Moon in 1978 is a shadow of his former self at this point. And I think the frustrations are growing with his personal foibles. So this is liberating in a sense for Pete, because now he can do these different styles. And this is a perfect example. And I think this track works wonders. It's a really cool song.
Yeah, it's more artsy. Yeah. And they already started doing a little bit of that on Who Are You? But I think that it's kind of dictating that direction that Pete was going with his solo work, too. And Kenny Jones played on Empty Glass, so he had worked with him before. So, yeah, I agree. I think that it did really open up a lot for Pete as far as just being able to explore different styles. And I think for Roger, too, he spent so many years kind of in that real forceful front man. But I think that he really liked to sort of explore different styles as well. And it didn't necessarily mean that it was going to be popular with Who fans or, you know, even with anyone, maybe. Like, they were kind of going out on a limb on some of these songs. And I mean, You Better You Bet, it was a hit. It was in the top 10. I think that they wrote that song specifically to be a radio song. And they also made music videos for You Better You Bet, Don't Let Go the Coat, and Another Tricky Day. And You Better You Bet was the sixth music video played on MTV.
Okay.
So they were getting very early exposure.
By the way, great vocal lead vocal by Roger, but one of the elements that lifts this song to the stratosphere is Pete Townsend's backing vocals on the verses. Those
call and response, you know.
Yeah.
You better, you better, you bet. Yeah.
That's their mastery of pop production. I mean, that's pure Beach Boys pop.
It's like a perfect harmonics pop song. And this is why I love it so much when they play it live. That part in the middle where it's, you better love me all the time now. You better shove me back into line now.
I'm so glad you mentioned this, because when I finally had my deep listening session with this album and it broke through for me, my first response to that was, oh, they're kind of influenced by Queen here in this bridge. Oh. It's kind of operatic sounding. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. No, I've got that backwards. Queen got that from The Who. The Who was doing rock operas long before Queen released their first record. So it's the other way around. The Who was very influential on Queen's operatic rock style.
Yeah.
I said, You Better You Bet, great lyric, until the very end of the song, when the life knife rhyme, it doesn't bug me during the course of the song. But then when you get to the tail end and it's like the dramatic finish, you better bet your life or love will cut you. Just like I don't know what, Pete, a knife maybe? It's just a little obvious, right? It's just a little obvious. I wonder if that kind of bugs him a little bit.
Yeah, I could maybe, It's never bothered me, but...
It never noticed it. During the song itself,
it's because they have, slowed down dramatic ending.
But it's just so dramatic at the end. Yes. It's like, it's a little clunky, isn't it? Just a little obvious. Oh, I'm sorry, Pete. I apologize. We love the song, and it's definitely going on our playlist. So all of side two is good on this record, I think, start to finish.
Yeah. I have probably spent the least amount of time with this album, and it's hard, although I have listened to it plenty. And I think mostly, too, because I'm more into Pete's solo albums from 80 and 82. So if I was going to choose, I would choose to listen to those. And I think part of it too is that I don't always love Roger's vocals in the songs that are less powerful.
Right. And yeah.
And so I think that sometimes they almost come across too much like show tunes or like in a Broadway-ish in a way.
That's a bit, again, that's a big element of Pete's style.
It is.
It's way more evident on Empty Glass. I think we mentioned that too. There's kind of Broadway sounding songs in there. Yeah.
But I think it works better. That style works better with Pete's vocals than Roger's for me. Yeah.
No, and I said it when we talked about Empty Glass. I think Pete Townsend's a very underrated vocalist. I think he's a very good singer.
You've got to
separate great voice from great singer. He doesn't have a great voice. He's got a kind of high, whiny, nasally voice. But what he does with it, he's a very talented singer.
Mm-hmm. He's a very expressive singer. He's about the polar opposite of Roger, which is what makes them interesting as a band.
The number one thing as a singer to be successful, you are selling the lyric. You have to sell the lyric. However that gets done, that's
and
the primary goal.
And I think it can be tough for Roger because Pete's lyrics oftentimes are very emotional and personal. Yeah. And
that's
really
why we get back to the criticism
of Roger's personality.
Right. See, he does not sell the lyric on Don't Let Go of the Coat. He doesn't sell the lyric on
Cash Cash. No, he's not feeling it. It's obvious. And which really is a credit to Roger Daltrey for the most part of the Who's catalog is he does a pretty amazing job of expressing Pete's emotion.
I think you're going there already. I'll let you finish.
I was going to say he's an actor.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
He's an actor too.
And that's how he views his role. He is acting out these characters that Pete's writing.
Mm-hmm.
So selling a lyric was definitely a bigger task for our other artist here, which is Steve Winwood, who releases the Ark of a Diver album on New Year's Eve, 1980. And then the single, the first single from the record, Why You See a Chance, comes out in the United States in February. I have the 45, which I bought as a youngster contemporarily. Loved this song from the moment I first heard it. But Steve Winwood, I would have had no preconceptions about what he represented or what his music was, because I had never heard of the man as a sixth grader when this song came out. Didn't know anything about his history. Now, I would have known a lot about The Who before hearing You Better You Bet, would have been familiar with a lot of their music. Maybe not the classic rock, you know, Who's Next, Quadrophenia stuff as much as their 60s, Tommy and their hit stuff from the 60s. But I had no knowledge about Steve Winwood's history in the music business at this point. So for me, he's a new artist.
And what a history.
Right, exactly. And I think this probably applies to a lot of casual music fans who know Steve Winwood's solo hits, starting with this song, While You See a Chance. And then he had a huge hit record a few years later with Back in the High Life and Higher Love, was a number one single that year. And then the next two singles were hits off that record as well. So a lot of people know Steve Winwood from these songs. And I think there's plenty of casual music fans who are very familiar with this music, don't know his history, which is legendary, starting in the 1960s as this boy wonder coming out of the Midlands in England. He was born in Birmingham, raised in the outskirts of Birmingham, kind of in a bucolic environment on the edge of farmlands and countryside. But he's just one of those people, and there's many of them in the history of music, that just have a gift. Mm-hmm. It's very apparent at a young age that just have this facility for music. And it starts out as a keyboard player, but then his older brother, Muff, who he would be in a band with later on, Muff Winwood would be a big producer and executive in music later on, picks up the guitar and starts playing in bands. Steve's like, oh, I'll have a go at that. And just naturally figured it out.
Picks it up.
Picks it up right away and becomes fluent on it right away. And much to Muff's surprise and kind of chagrin, it's like, oh my God, this kid is just a natural. He eventually masters several instruments and then he starts singing. I guess his early inspiration was Ray Charles. And so he starts singing in this incredibly soulful voice that just belies his young age. And then both he and Muff end up in the Spencer Davis Group in the mid-60s. And they have a big hit with Keep On Running. And then he becomes this sensation, certainly among fellow musicians who are just blown away. It's like, I can't believe this young kid from Birmingham in England, this young white kid, is singing like a great black soul star. And he just starts to immerse himself in music, all types of music, ends up leaving the Spencer Davis Group to start a band called Traffic. Their first records are very much of the era, which is, you know, Summer of Love, 67, psychedelic era, but the English style of psychedelia. So that's the first record. Rock fans will certainly know Dear Mr. Fantasy, which comes out, which is the legendary song of this era, an absolute classic. Their second record, I think, is Superior, which is the self-titled album. There's another member of this band, Dave Mason, who goes on to some solo acclaim later on, but they're constantly butting heads. Steve is very much into the hippie thing, and he wants the band to be more organic and roots-oriented to rock. Well, Mason kind of has this pop gift, and he writes a couple of their hit singles, which doesn't go down well with Steve, ends up leaving the group. They bring him back for the second record, and he said he almost felt like not really a member of the band, just as a guest, but he ends up writing the single that gets chosen, which is a classic, Feeling All Right. Most people know it better by the Joe Cocker version. So he's kind of in and out in the band, Dave Mason, but writes some of their classic songs. But the second record, a lot earthier, a lot rootsier, a lot more soulful. There's still some psychedelia on it. They have their first venture to America, and they open for the Grateful Dead. They stay with the Dead in San Francisco. So they're very much of that milieu. Probably their greatest album for me is the John Barleycorn album. And they'd already kind of split up. That was to be Steve Winwood's first solo album, but he gets other members of Traffic on board. Jim Capaldi, the drummer, who is also a lyricist on a lot of their songs. And then Chris Wood is the kind of the secret sauce that makes Traffic special with his work on saxophone and flute and various wind instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And he's bringing in all these different exotic influences to the band, world music and jazz. And so Traffic was cool because it's just this pot of all these different styles. And they released these legendary records. John Barleycorn Must Die comes out in 1970. The Low Spark of High Heeled Boys, we've already talked about that in our Jim Gordon episode. That's a different vibe because they bring in Jim Gordon as a session drummer to augment Jim Capaldi.
And Low Spark of High Heeled Boys is a song that you hear on classic rock radio for years, you know, the long extended.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that could have easily been, you know, when we picked our favorite Jim Gordon moments, that could have easily been one. He only drums on that record. For the next one, they bring in the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, David Hood and Roger Hawkins on drums. I don't love that record so much, but the live album that came out after that, On the Road, is excellent. If you're into like jam band music, that's a great listen. And then they just kind of peter out with, you know, Shoot Out the Fantasy Factory and then When the Eagle Flies. Steve Winwood kind of lays low for a while. He does some session work on a, you know, kind of fusion-y type albums in the middle part of the decade. His first solo album comes out in 77, doesn't really get a foothold. I have it. I haven't listened to it much. That's something I need to explore a little more. But commercially, it doesn't really go anywhere for him. So he's not really a household name in America. On FM radio, he's had a lot of songs played in the Traffic days, for sure. And then, you know,
he was also in the super group Blind Faith.
Oh, yeah, I did skip past that. That was huge. That was
Ginger Baker and Eric Clapton and Rick Rudge.
That was a number one record in both sides of the Atlantic. And they were a major tour with Blind Faith and Eric Clapton. So you had a lot of songs on FM radio with Steve Winwood all over them. Can't Find My Way Home from the Blind Faith album. Certainly Low Spark of High Heeled Boys. Other songs by Traffic would have been played Dear Mr. Fantasy on FM radio.
But people didn't really know Steve Winwood
and
that he was part of these bands, even though he's the lead singer.
And he's fading from view now. So it's been a few years since Traffic really put out anything that had much of airplay or commercial foothold. So he kind of reinvents himself with the solo album, and it is a true solo album. He records all the instruments himself. Now he's a gentleman farmer up in the Cotswolds in England. And he's got his home studio, and he's really immersed himself in the emerging synthesizer technology. And these synths are all over this record. Synthesizers, drum machines, although he does play the drums himself, and he drums quite adequately on this record. He is an underrated guitarist, so that was a feature really from the get-go. He played a lot of lead guitar in the Spencer Davis Group. I guess we should mention Gimme Some Lovin'. That's what most people would know
from
his Spencer Davis Group days. That's an oldies radio staple. And then mm-hmm. even better than that was their version of I'm a Man, which is yes. just rocks hard. Incredible vocal on that.
And so I mean, those songs really showcase his vocals. And he was 16 when he recorded those songs.
Just insane.
Yeah.
So now he's reemerging with this true solo record in the kind of the Stevie Wonder, Todd Rundgren mold, where he's playing and singing everything, layering vocals, layering keyboards, playing the bass and the drums. He's playing electric bass along with synthesizer bass on a lot of this record. And it's a very modern sound. It's very much mm-hmm. cutting edge, heading into end of 1980, into 1981. But he's not writing any of the lyrics. So he drafts in this American lyricist by the name of Will Jennings. Will Jennings, he's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's had a lot of, he's probably best known for two songs that were in movies, Up Where We Belong from Officer and a Gentleman, which was an Oscar winner, and then My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, Celine Dion song. Also wrote Tears from Heaven for Eric Clapton, mm-hmm. which was massive, among a bunch of other things. He wrote a couple of big Barry Manilow hits, Looks Like We Made It was one. So Will Jennings is the lyricist. He writes the lyrics to Why You See a Chance. And it's just kind of it's got a positive message about the world is there for you. You know, you control your happiness and what you're able to accomplish. But it's the keyboard sounds of this record that mm-hmm. we've talked about this. I've talked about this a few times on the show. The synthesizers of this era are so much better. The sound of these things, the analog synths of this era, I like so much more than the synth sounds you would get later on in the 80s when the digital synths, you know, the Yamaha DX7s and those type of synths came around. I've tried to pin down what were the actual keyboards, and I think they're Yamahas for the most part, which were very, very advanced instruments for this time, for what their capability was. They were big, huge, heavy things too, and super expensive. Like the synth sound on Led Zeppelin's In Through the Outdoor. The sounds that Donald Fagen was getting on Gaucho and his first solo record, which came out the next year, The Night Fly. Just those warm, mm-hmm. warm, enveloping sounds.
You know, since sort of became the antithesis of that, where they became like the very mechanic, tinny kind of, these are very warm and feel like they just have more like a wash over them. And this album is so synth heavy. It really is. It's very much like what Gary Wright was doing, or mm-hmm. you know, like Dreamweaver in the late 70s.
Several years before.
Where synthesizers, whatever he was using, the array of keyboards, are the main instrument and vocals.
And it's his vocals that make his music special. He just has this incredibly soulful voice. And honestly, he's still got it.
Yeah.
The thing that strikes me here is this is a veteran rocker. He's been in all these well-known bands, had all this success starting in the mid-60s. So he is very much a veteran rocker, but he's still so young. I mean, he's only 31, 32 when this record comes out.
Yeah, he started so early.
Right, that, exactly, because he was 16 when he first started hitting. So, you know, Pete Townsend's a little older than him, but mm-hmm. Pete's already been playing the aging rocker since The Who by Numbers. I mean, that's kind of his ongoing theme and continues on Face Dances. While Steve Winwood, people are looking at, it's the reemergence of this veteran rocker, but he's still a very young man at this point.
Youngish. I mean, he's still in his 30s, I guess. But I think the thing about this album, this sound would have been popular in the, you know, mid 70s too. But because, you know, he's using the synthesizers, it still resonates in this era too. Although when I think of this song, I really do think of it more of like a 70s song.
When you watch the music video, it certainly screams. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is early 80s visual aesthetic, and it's all over that music video. There's a great documentary put out BBC called English Soul about Steve Winwood and his whole career, and just loads of classic vintage footage in this. But he's, you know, Steve Winwood's just kind of a humble, down-to-earth guy, and he's just very pragmatic about all of it. He was not into this whole 80s glitz and glamour thing, but he'd been advised, all right, this is the way you need to look. You need to do these music videos. You need to dance and shake your booty a little. And this is later on when Back in the High Life
comes
out.
Higher Love.
But, you know, he's like, okay, I mean, I want to sell these records. This is something I have to do. It's not really me per se. It's not my personality. But if it's going to help get the music out there, it's just something you got to do. So he swallows it. And if you look at the vintage performance footage of Steve Winwood from his early days in the Spencer Davis Group, into Traffic, into Blind Faith. He never looked comfortable performing live. First of all, it blows you away to hear that incredible, powerful, soulful voice, and then see just the effortlessness with which it's coming out of his mouth and his body. He's not, yeah. I mean, he's not gurning, and there's not a lot of expression. It's just coming out. You know, he's kind of wide-eyed. He kind of looks like he's, you know, a little bit nervous in a lot of the performance footage.
Yeah.
And then you get to the videos for Back in the High Life, and he's got his suit and his, you know, his
mullet,
his haircut, and his shaking his ass, and he's got, oh yeah.
Well, you know, that comeback is almost like on par with Tina Turner's, you know, far as like becoming popular again in the mid 80s and from an artist that's been around for so long and really already had like such a huge career.
I do remember thinking, oh, this guy's older. You know, he's not like the, he's mm-hmm. a new art. It's like he's a new artist, but he's old. But he's really not that old. I mean, he's only like 31 or 32, which I guess seemed kind of old then. Now it doesn't seem that old.
Yeah, because everybody's old now that we like. But yeah, I know. I know what you're saying. You know, George Harrison, the Beatles, Paul McCartney, like they're of that age. They're a little older too. And like the Pete Townsend and them. But Steve Winwood, I think that because he was really using the synthesizer technology too, he had a more contemporary sound that could have been an artist that just came along in 1981.
Sure,
you
absolutely.
Know, and recorded this album and without having the history that he had.
The whole album is good. So it starts off with While You See a Chance. The title track, Arc of a Diver, really cool song. So, you know, he's embracing these modern sounds. We're going to talk more in another episode about Phil Collins and the Face Value album. But he's kind of embracing the modern sounds, you know, the new synthesizer technology and recording technology provides. Picking up from where he left off, playing on Peter Gabriel's 3 in 1980. And then, you know, Roxy Music has that really sophisticated modern sound at this time, too. I kind of lump them all in together a little bit. But Arc of a Diver definitely, it's kind of got a Roxy feel to it with this kind of slick, sophisticated
yes,
sound.
Yes, it does feel slick and sophisticated in a way. It feels adult.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which he is. You know, he is.
Yeah.
He's not some new kid on the block at this point. So you've got these real modern sounds of the, you know, Secondhand Woman and then Arc of a Diver. And then the last song on side one, I just adore it. And that's a more organic sound. Slow Down Sundown really harkens back to the band, I think, in the vibe that song gives out. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't really listened to this full album. I've had it forever, but I've listened to it quite a few times over the last week, and it just keeps getting better and better. It's a great album, and I've known it was. I mean, it's a 5-star album, you know, but I just hadn't given it the time. And now I'm just kind of really getting the nuances. And I also didn't realize he played every instrument and that it was a real, you know, one-man show. And he's incredibly talented. And I would know that from everything he's done in the past, too. But this just kind of solidifies that. I mean, this album deserves all the praise it's ever gotten. It really is a great album.
And it's funny because the albums that bookended either side, his first solo record in 77 and then the one that followed, Talking Back to the Night, neither of those took off. So it kind of had a couple of misfires on either side of this record. But then again, you would hit even bigger heights down the road with
this feels like an album that he really just went into the studio and just made the album he wanted to make. I mean, While You See a Chance is a pretty long song. You know, it's over 5 minutes long. And, you know, it doesn't really like come across as being a single necessarily that is made for pop radio, but it became a big hit for him. And it doesn't feel like an album that he went into the studio with an intention to record something that was going to be popular necessarily. Like Spanish Dancer, that's a song I remember hearing on classic rock radio, and it's kind of strange. It's got these weird synths, but it's really cool. I love it. And also a pretty long song. In fact, most of the songs, Night Train is over 7 minutes. You know, a lot of the songs on this album are pretty long, but they don't get boring. They're not super complicated, but they're interesting. And so much of that too is just his vocal delivery, and his voice is so engaging.
Yeah. Whatever era of Steve Winwood you're talking about. I mean, he's obviously a gifted musician, multi-instrumentalist, outstanding keyboard player, underrated guitar player. And I didn't really pick up on how much guitar he's actually played throughout his career until, you know, recent years. I mean, he played a lot of lead guitar from the get-go back in the teenage years with Spencer Davis Group, and he played a lot more guitar in Traffic. Remember, you know, Dave Mason was kind of in and out early on, and so you had a guitarless group. I mean, I think the perception of Steve Winwood is as a keyboard player, but he is very good on guitar as well. And then, obviously, one of the great vocalists in rock history. I laid out four songs that we want to look at from the early. We're not going to have time to get to them all today, but they're kind of all linked together. And it's all kind of veteran artists. Even Rick Springfield, who had Jesse's Girl come out in 1981, he'd been plugging along for quite a while. He was releasing albums in the late 60s in Australia, and the Zoot album, he was part of this band. Zoot came out in 1970. B. Birtles of Little River Band was part of that group as well. And then a lot of people don't realize Rick Springfield had a solo hit, minor chart hit, but it was a top 40. It was top 20, I believe, in the United States way back in 1972. But then he kind of fell off the radar for a number of reasons before reemerging with the Working Class Dog album and then Jesse's Girl, which was just a home run for him.
Huge.
In 1981, helped by the fact that he had daily exposure on American TV on a very popular soap opera, General Hospital. And maybe his looks helped him a little bit.
Yes.
I don't know, Cheryl, you might be able to speak to that.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Anybody can see the guy's incredibly good looking. But it's a great song.
But really, he's talented.
Yes.
He's a talented musician.
Yes.
And I think it would have been easy for American audiences to kind of look at him as just, oh, he's just a soap star. He's just another face. But, you know, like you said, he had a music career. So at that point, he was already somewhat of a veteran. But Jesse's Girl is just such a perfect pop song. And that entire album is great.
That song is so good that I think there's this perception, even from people our age who don't really remember, he had a whole run. I mean, he had a whole bunch of hit songs, bunch of songs that got played on the radio and MTV. But there's this kind of perception of him as a one-hit wonder just because Jesse's Girl just stands out as just this great song that's transcended the ages. And for good reason.
It's a pillar of the 80s.
Yes, for good reason. It's a great pop song.
Right. Great riff.
Wonderful lyric.
Yeah. Great vocals. It really is a song that probably will never go away.
Yeah.
Which just, I have no problem with that because it's a song I can hear over and over again. I never get tired of it.
I love the lyric. I think it's such a clever lyric on this. And he's the writer. He's the sole songwriter on this song. He's a guitar player, vocalist, but he does get in a couple of heavy guitar players on this album, which, you know, it is a power pop record and there's some kick-ass stuff on it. Love Is All Right Tonight.
Yeah.
Really, that's a great power pop song leading off the record. But he's got Neil Giraldo, who is Pat Benatar's paramour, but her lead guitarist and songwriter. And honestly, you know, until Pat Benatar got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame a few years ago, I don't think a lot of people realize what a partnership that was between the two of them. I mean, it's the two of them. It's not just her. I mean, he writes the songs. He's an incredible guitar player. And it's been a partnership from the get-go. But Neil Giraldo plays on Rick Springfield's record. Also, Robin Ford, outstanding guitar player. He was a teenage guitar player in Joni Mitchell's group when she toured the Court and Spark album. So this guy's got some serious chops.
And kind
of
like solo, kind of blues, kind of blues-based, right?
Definitely from the blues jazz idiom. So he's got some killer players on this record, but the lyric on Jesse's Girl is just so clever. And as kids, the one standout is the point is probably moot. I don't think a lot of us at this time were aware of that phrase. Like, what is he saying?
I thought he was meant to say mute and he said moot instead. Or, what, you know, I remember specifically hearing that line and being like, what?
But I mean, just the way the song scans, it's very clear. She, you know, she's loving him with that body. I just know it. Just an interesting way of phrasing that. And it's just a very clever lyric from start to finish. You know, it's a familiar theme. He's lusting after his friend's girlfriend. And then another thing that's interesting about this song, the spelling of Jesse with the IE. I mean, most people would see that. And that's generally going to be a girl's name when it's spelled like that.
Yeah, like Jessica, like short for Jessica.
Yeah. So why, you know, why is it Jesse not?
Right, because it'd be J-E-S-S-E if it's a guy's spelling. Yeah,
and then Carly Simon had a hit the previous year with Jesse. Jesse, oh. I won't cut fresh flowers for you. And Jesse, I won't make the wine cold. For you.
I don't remember that one song.
Oh, no, that's a big hit. It's a big hit for Carly Simon. But that's Jesse the man's way.
I've never thought about that. Yeah.
So I wonder, it's like, okay, is that to differentiate it from the Carly Simon song? But the real story was, I mean, he was inspired by a friend's hot girlfriend. They were all taking a art class together, stained glass making.
That's very 80s.
And he didn't want to use the real names of these people. And he saw the name Jesse, I.E., on, it was either a shirt he was wearing or his friend was wearing. So Ron Jesse was a wide receiver for the L.A. Rams at this time that he wrote the song. And so he saw the Jesse name on the, and it's spelled J-E-S-S-I-E.
Okay.
And that inspired the spell. I'd never heard that story before.
No. Well, I love this song because it has so many different parts to it, you know, and like, I love how it starts out quiet and then how it builds and then how it's got that drum break and the do, 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 and that riff in the middle. It's just, the riff is so catchy. It's a classic.
Yep. It's a song that has transcended the decades. Even folks way younger than us would be very familiar with this song. And honestly, that's what a lot of people remember about Rick Springfield, is this one song, although he did have about a 5-year run there from 80 to 85, where he was pretty popular throughout and had a bunch of hits. And then he kind of stepped away. I guess he's battled depression his whole life too, and that's been a factor in his career, ups and downs. But
he kind of made his way back in like about 10 years ago now. He was kind of doing the circuit and you were seeing him on talk shows and he was touring again. So he did have a resurgence.
So that song has definitely had staying power. Now, another veteran band, we signposted this song way back when Cheryl picked a song for the playlist in 1976, was Climax Blues Band. And we're kind of running out of time to talk about it, but we said maybe the greatest two-hit wonder.
Yes.
Their two-hit songs, United States. And the two songs are very unalike. And their second hit kind of tore up the band. So we definitely want to reserve more time to talk about it. It's a song I love. Cheryl is less enthused about it, but
I love the song. I just think the lyrics are so goofy and it's kind of one of those really out of place songs in 1981. Like, it does not feel like it was released in 1981.
Well, that's certainly what the rest of the band felt. And we'll detail that story. We also want to talk about a couple of albums that came out Valentine's week in 1981, and that's Rush's Moving Pictures, which I figured would be a contender for Cheryl's album of the year.
It's so close. It is a close second.
And then Phil Collins for his solo album. We're going to talk more about that a little later on, because Genesis releases a big album later on in 81. We'll kind of talk about that all in one group. But that is among many more things to come on Matt and Cheryl's Gen Excellent playlist.
Yeah, we've got so much to talk about in 1981.
And Jesse's Girl, we're not putting it on the playlist. We wanted to talk about it, but it was on both of our preliminary lists. But
it's hovering around the playlist.
A lot of great songs aren't going to make it, sadly. Even though it seems like 18 is a lot to choose. It goes very fast. And there were a lot of great singles in 1981. So we'll talk more about that and other things in our next go round. Until then, I'm Matt.
I'm Cheryl.
And you've been listening to Matt and Cheryl's Gen Excellent Playlist. Thanks for tuning in. Take care, everybody.